When Zave Campbell and the 31 Gonzales men broke through Mexican lines and entered the Alamo at 3 in the morning of Tuesday, the 1st of March, they found a legendary man who, even though confined to his cot, gave them hope. He was Jim Bowie, 41 years old, and revered as the best knife fighter on the entire frontier. He was a big, red-headed man of enormous energy, and had the wishes of the men who were to do the fighting been consulted, he would have been their commander during the siege. Unluckily, on the day Santa Ana's men took their positions ringing the Alamo, Bowie, who had been ill for some time, was laid low by a raging fever, somewhat like the one that had killed his wife, Ursula Veramendi. And when Zave went to report, he found Bowie in bed. "I've heard of you," Bowie said. "Glad to have you." "You look pale," Zave said. "Like maybe Santa Annie hit you with something." Bowie said wanly, "And you look like your neck's on crooked, like maybe somebody tried to hang you." "Necks don't straighten easy," Zave confessed. And the two old frontiersmen discussed the places and people they had known, especially in and around Natchez. "Is it true you used to wrestle alligators?" Zave asked. "Still do, if one comes after me," Bowie said, laughing. "Man never knows when a gator is gonna come after him." Zave would never see this once powerful man standing upright, but he was impressed by the sheer sense of force that Bowie exuded, even from his cot. When the sick man learned that Campbell had also married a Mexicana, he said, "There's another fellow in here like us." And when he sent for Mordecai Marr, these three Texicans shared memories of the joys they had known with their Mexican wives. "The others think we married peasants," Bowie said. "You should have heard my wife order me about. She was twice as smart as me." The three men fell silent, for at the far end of the barracks in which Bowie's cot stood, they saw Amalia Marr moving about, assisting the women and children who had chosen to stay in the Alamo with their men. And the graceful way she held her head, the poetry of her motion as she worked, delighted them. For Bowie and Campbell could see in her a portrait of their own wives. It was then that Bowie exclaimed with deep emotion, "Damn it, Campbell, it would have been a lot better for Texas if every unmarried man who wandered down here from Kentucky or Tennessee, or from Georgia and Alabama for that matter, if he had been forced to take himself a Mexican wife. Maybe we could have bridged the gap." "What gap?" Zave asked. "Americanos, Mexicanos, we're bound to share this land for the next 200 years. If we'd got started right." "They tell me that this guide, Deaf Smith, best of the lot, they say he has a Mexican wife." "I think he does," Bowie said. "I wish he was in here to help us." "The men all feel they'd have a better chance of holding this place if you was leading." "Now stop that. Stop it right now. Travis'll prove a damned good fighting man." "But the men tell me," Marr said, "that you were supposed to be in command." Jim Bowie, the most belligerent man in the Alamo, sighed. "It hasn't been a neat affair. Seems like nothing in Texas is ever neat. We were supposed to share a joint command, Travis in charge of the army men, me in charge of the volunteers." "That's what I'm saying. Us volunteers want to fight under your orders." Bowie's voice hardened with exasperation. "How in hell can I command if I can't stand? You tell me that." With the generosity of spirit which marked him, he growled, "I'm perfectly willing to give the leadership to Travis." And while neither Zave nor Marr believed him, they had to respect him for his soldierly deportment. The man all the newcomers wanted to meet was Davy Crockett, the former congressman from Tennessee. Tall, clean-shaven, and with a head somewhat larger than normal, he was a famous raconteur whose disreputable stories, narrated in dialect, often made him look ridiculous. "They was me and this bear and a Injun. Now, that bear was grinding his teeth just waiting to get at me, and the Injun was reaching for his arrows to shoot one through me." "And what were you doing?" someone was supposed to ask, at which Davy would reply, "I'd be ashamed to tell you, except that later I had to do some washing." He was irrepressible, and after conducting a survey of the situation within the Alamo, he had insisted upon defending the palisaded weak spot where the danger would be greatest. "I want 16 good men here with all the rifles we can muster, and them Mexicans better beware." When Zave saw the frailness of the palisade and the grim look of the men from Kentucky and Tennessee who would have to defend it, he whispered to Galba Fuqua, "There's bound to be one hell of a fight here." Whenever Zave could not locate Galba, for whom he felt great responsibility, he would look to see where Davy Crockett was holding forth, and there the boy would be, listening intently as the wild frontiersman spun his yarns. But fully aware that Crockett's mocking manner masked a character of profound determination. The boy had no way of assessing how strong a man Jim Bowie might have been if healthy, but he knew that Davy was one of the most powerful men he had ever seen. "You killed more'n 100 bears?" "Most dangerous animal I ever met was that Tennessee Democrat, Andrew Jackson. He'd cut a man's throat for sixpence." "But did you kill 47 bears in 1 month?" Galba asked. "I sure did. 47 bears, 46 bullets." "How was that?" "Two of the bears was misbehavin'," and he winked at the boy. One morning, Galba was standing guard with him atop the fort at the southwestern end of the mission. Crockett was dressed as usual. Coonskin cap, deerskin jacket with Indian beads, buckskin trousers, and beside him he had two long rifles. "You see that Mexican over there across the river?" he said to Galba, "tracing marks in the dust? You see that other man behind him? As soon as I fire, slap the other gun into my hand." The two men were so far distant that Galba believed it impossible for Crockett to reach them, but he watched as the expert leveled his gun, firmed it against the edge of the rampart, and with breathless care pulled back his trigger finger. Poof! Not much of a crackle, for this was a good, tight gun. But down went the man in front. "Quick!" Davy whispered, as if the other man could hear. And before the latter could seek refuge, a second bullet sped across the river, dipped under the trees on the far side, and splatted into its target. Insolently, Crockett rose from behind the protective wall, pushed back his coonskin cap, and reloaded his two rifles, daring Santa Ana's men to fire at him with their outdated smooth-bore English muskets that could not carry half that distance. "How far was that?" Galba asked, as if the dead men had been squirrels. Crockett said with equal indifference, "Maybe 250 yards," but quickly added, "You know, you couldn't do it at that range, not unless you could prop your gun." "Could I fight with you at the palisade?" Crockett said, "It's going to be easy to hold that spot, what with the men I got. A good shot like you, you're needed wherever Travis puts you." That night, Galba Fuqua lost his heart all over again to Davy Crockett, for the famous bear hunter astounded everyone by producing a fiddle that he brought into the Alamo with him, and for 2 hours he entertained the fighters with scraping squeals of mountain music, so ingratiating that even Zave Campbell danced in the moonlight. When Colonel Travis was assigning the Gonzales men to their defensive positions, Zave volunteered for one of the more exposed locations. He chose that long western wall, knowing it would be vulnerable if the Mexican foot soldiers were brave enough to bring their scaling ladders there. To Fuqua, who volunteered to stand with him, he said, "What we must do, Galb, is run back and forth and change our positions, confuse them." "Will there be lots of them?" "Lots." And he pointed out to the boy where the danger spots would be. "That gully gives them protection. They'll come up from there and hit us about here. We'll be waiting. You keep your eye on those trees. Not many of them, but they'll interrupt our fire. They're sure to come at us from those trees. So you're to guard this point and never allow them to place even one ladder. What am I to do? The minute they place a ladder, you run there with this forked pole and push it down. The boy looked at the trees, saw the pitiful distance that separated them from the wall, and for the first time since he left Gonzales, realized that within a few days men were going to be killed in great number. "Will many be killed, Mr. Campbell?" "Lots," Zave said. Then, appreciating the boy's fear, he took Galba by the hand and said, "That's what a battle is, son, the killing of men." "Does the red flag over there really mean no surrender?" "It's them or us, son. Come battle day, it's purely them or us." At first, Campbell had not liked Colonel Travis, whom he saw as an austere man with a lawyer's finicky attitude toward duty and no sense of humor. "He talks too big, Galb." The boy repeated what he had heard many of the men say. "Bowie ought to be our commander." But out of respect for the sick man's wishes, Zave quieted such talk. "Travis is our leader now. Bowie said so, and you better do what he says." By Wednesday, the 2nd of March, Campbell was developing a much different opinion of Travis. "He knows what he's doing. He knows how to defend a position. And look how he puts his finger on the weak spots." Zave liked especially the manner in which Travis disposed his men, never carelessly, never arbitrarily, but always with an eye on firepower. "You know, Galb, he has every weak man down there caring for the cattle and things. All the good men are up here on the ramparts." "You count me a good man?" "I sure do, and so does Travis." But not even after Zave had granted Travis every concession did he like the man the way he admired Bowie and Crockett. "It's the way he's always tidying up his clothes, Galb. When a man does that, he's apt to be prissy. Damn it, Travis ought to be commanding a cavalry post in Carolina and attending afternoon teas with the ladies. He may be a fighting man, but he sure as hell ain't a frontiersman." "You prefer the way Bowie dresses?" "I sure do." But as he said this, he saw Travis standing atop the fortress corner at the north, surveying the land across which the Mexican attack would come. And his slim figure, so taut, so tense, seemed so extraordinarily military that even Zave had to confess, "He knows what he's doing, that one." And when Travis next inspected the rooftops, Zave saluted. On Thursday, the 3rd of March, at about 10:45, Colonel Travis and everyone within hearing of Galba Fuqua's voice were startled to hear the lad cry, "Man coming on horseback!" And when they looked toward the sun high in the sky, they did indeed see a lone horseman making a wild effort to cut directly through the heart of the enemy lines. "It's Bonham," men began to shout. "Go it, Bonham!" They did more than shout. Two men limbered up a field piece and tossed cannon shells at Mexican soldiers who were trying to catch the fleeting messenger, while others grabbed their rifles to pick off individual men who sought to attack him. "Zave," Fuqua shouted, proudly aware that his warning cry had helped this incredibly brave rider by alerting the riflemen on the walls. "He's going to make it." "Break open those gates," Travis shouted, and men eagerly leaped to do so, just in time to bring the dodging, darting Bonham into the protection of the Alamo. Twice out to safety, twice back to his post of duty, he had ridden alone and had four times penetrated heavy enemy concentrations. His message was brief and terrifying. "Colonel Fannin refuses to leave Goliad. Gonzales has no more men to send us. No relief is on the way. You already have all the men you'll ever have. There'll be no more." Friday, the 4th of March, was a solemn day within the Alamo, for additional Mexican reinforcements streamed north from the Rio Grande to increase Santa Ana's superiority, so that even the most hopeful Texicans had to confront the fact that within a few hours the mighty attack would begin, and it could have only one outcome. Each of the doomed men spent this fateful day as his personality dictated. Jim Bowie almost wept at his inability to rise from his cot and help. Davy Crockett entertained his men at the Palisade with outrageous stories of his confrontations with his Tennessee constituents, and especially with President Andrew Jackson, whom he despised. All show and bluster, calls himself a friend of the common man, but the only people he really befriends are the rich. If we had a real man in the White House, we'd have 3,000 American troops in this building right now, and God knows how many cannon. He refused to allow any talk of odds or dangers or the likelihood of annihilation. He was in another tight spot, and he would, as always, do his best. James Bonham was exhausted and reflective. He could not understand Fannin. He simply could not understand. Obviously, he told Travis, he could have marched here 15 days ago. I broke through yesterday, and so could he with all the men he had. I fear a great disaster is going to overtake that poor man. He slept most of the afternoon. Zave Campbell, as a good Scotsman, had sought out a kinsman, John McGregor, who he found had brought with him into the Alamo a set of fine bagpipes. So, later in the afternoon, Campbell, Fuqua, and McGregor gathered in the northwest corner of the big field, and there McGregor marched back and forth as if he were in some royal castle on the Firth of Tay, piping the stirring reels and strathspeys of his youth. Then, without announcement, he switched to a most enchanting tune, not military at all. And when Campbell said, "I don't know that one," the piper explained, "We call it the Flowers of Embry, which means the Flowers of Edinburgh. A grand tune." He played this sad, sweet music for some time. Then, once more without warning, he altered his music. With head tilted back as if he were looking for omens in the sky, he offered the near-empty field one of the grand compositions of Scotland. And now Campbell knew well what it was, the great McCrimmon's Lament, that historic threnody for brave men dead in battle. And as he marched back and forth, men in various parts of the Alamo seemed to sense that he was playing some notable piece of music for them, and they began to appear from odd corners. But this haunting moment lasted only briefly, for Davy Crockett bellowed from the palisade, "Damn that stuff! Fetch me my fiddle!" And when this was done, he took it and ran the length of the field to meet with McGregor. And for about an hour, as day waned, the two men gave a wild and raucous concert of wailing pipes and screeching fiddle. And for a rowdy while, the 183 men in the Alamo forgot their predicament. Ominously, on Saturday, the 5th of March, the daily bombardment by the Mexicans, 13 days of barrage without killing one Texican, ceased. And Marr predicted to those about him, "Santa Anna's redeploying his troops. Tomorrow he'll come at us." Colonel Travis, reaching the same conclusion, experienced an overpowering sense of doom. And as he realistically surveyed the situation of his troops and the few women and children who had remained with them in the Alamo, he realized that to hope for any further miracles was futile. His aides reported, "Santa Anna's army increases daily. He's moving up his big guns. The final attack cannot be delayed much longer." Everything Travis saw confirmed this gloom. No matter how he disposed his men along the walls, there were empty spaces which the enemy would be sure to spot. And his ammunition was limited. Unlimited was the willingness of his men to fight. But as their leader, he felt obligated to give each man one last chance to escape the certain death which faced them all. That afternoon, he assembled his force near the plaza leading to the chapel. And there, with the women and children listening, and even Jim Bowie on his cot, which had been hauled into the open, he told them the facts. "The red flag still flies, and Santa Anna means it. No prisoners. His army is 15 times ours, and he has more cannon, too. I suspect the attack will come tomorrow. That's Sunday, isn't it? I want to offer every man here one last chance to retire if he should wish to. What happened next would be forever debated, some basing their accounts on those of certain women who escaped the carnage. Say that Travis drew a line in the sand with the tip of his sword and indicated that those wishing to take their chances fighting beside him step over it. Others laugh at the suggestion of such flamboyance, but grant that he may have indicated some kind of line as he scuffed his left foot across the plaza. At any rate, he certainly warned his men that death was imminent and gave them a choice of either staying and fighting a hopeless battle with him or kiting over the wall to such escape as each man could maneuver for himself. First over the line was white-haired Mordecai Marr, who mumbled to the two who followed, "I'm American and Mexican, loyal to both, but it seems like the first one wins." Jim Bowie, without question, asked that his cot be moved to where his one-time adversary was standing, and Travis welcomed him. Davy Crockett shuffled over, and of course James Bonham moved to accept the death which he had known 3 weeks ago to be inevitable. Zave Campbell looked down at Galba Fuqua, shrugged his shoulders, and said unheroically, "We've come this far, Galb. Do you want to go all the way?" Without hesitation, the boy took Zave's hand as they joined the Patriots. When Travis made his remarkable and moving speech, 182 men and boys faced him. Of that number, all but one crossed to die with him. The one man who did not, and his reasoning for preferring shameful life to heroic death, was startling to the men who heard him voice it, was Louis Rose, 51 years old, born in France and entitled to wear the Legion of Honor as a distinguished veteran of Napoleon's campaigns in the Kingdom of Naples and in Russia. He had come to Texas as early as 1826, when he changed his first name to Moses, believing it to sound more American. At first, he had served as a day laborer in Nacogdoches, then as a teamster, and finally as a self-trained butcher. Loving the soldier's life, as soon as trouble threatened, he mortgaged all his holdings and went off to join the fighting at San Antonio, where he had helped defeat General Cos in 1835. Rose was by far the most experienced soldier in the group, and it pained Jim Bowie to see such a man reluctant to stay for the fight. Forcing himself upright in his cot, Bowie chided the Frenchman. "You seem unwilling to die with us, Mose." "I came to America to live a new life, not to die needlessly," the old campaigner said. "Only fools and amateurs would try to defend this place." Davy Crockett said with a touch of levity, "Mose, you may as well die with us, because you'll never get through them Mexican lines." "I speak Spanish," Rose said. And he bundled up his clothes, climbed the wall to the very spot where Galba Fuqua would stand guard, and hesitated for a moment as if reconsidering. Looking back at his friends, he half nodded, then turned and abruptly leaped to the ground, where he quickly lost himself among the trees. At 3:30, in the cold morning of Sunday, the 6th of March, Galba Fuqua reached over and nudged his friend Zave Campbell as they stood watch atop the long barracks. "I think they're coming." Zave rubbed his eyes and peered into the darkness, seeing for himself that there was much movement among the trees to the west. "I think you're right, Galb. Hey, where are you going?" "I got a pee." "You stay here." "But I got a pee." "So do I." When men face danger, like a fistfight or a hurricane or a battle like this, they often have to pee, even the bravest. "I do too. But up where I'm needed, not down there." So the man and the boy urinated against the adobes which they were about to defend. And as they finished, Zave said something that would encourage the boy mightily in the frenzied hours ahead. "Galb, it's gonna be a tough fight, that's sure. If you see me showing any signs of cowardice, You could never be a coward, Mr. Campbell. No man ever knows. So if I start to show signs, you kick me in the ankle. You don't have to say anything. Just kick me in the ankle, and we'll know what it means. The boy considered this, then said in a trembling voice, I see shadows moving, Mr. Campbell. A hush, then. Oh, they're coming. Then, in the darkness of the night, 7 Mexican buglers, each marching with his own contingent, started sounding one of the most powerful calls ever heard on the world's battlefields. It was not a piercing command to charge, nor a stirring cry to enhance courage. It was the degüello, an ancient Moorish plea to an enemy to surrender. Its name meant the beheading, and once it sounded, its meaning was stark and clear. If you do not surrender immediately, we shall behead you, everyone. Across the empty fields of Béjar it came, over the walls and into the Alamo, this wild lament, this recollection of home, of people loved, of the gentler scenes of peace. Through the vast spaces of the Alamo it echoed, and everyone who heard it understood its frightful promise that within hours everyone inside the walls would be slain. 9 times the degüello was repeated, a terrible tattoo, bringing the small, white-clad Indian troops ever closer to the walls. Don't waste your bullets, Campbell told Galba. They'll be close soon enough. Santa Anna had assigned tasks skillfully. Cos, you command our best troops. Hit the northwest wall. General Duque, smash the northeast. That's where I'm sure we can break through. Riparda, you have the ones we can send forth in floods. Knock down the palisade. Morales, hit the main gate. But when they concentrate to defend it, slide off to your left. You'll find a weak spot. The rest of you, scaling ladders against that long west wall. They can't protect all of it. During the first minutes of battle, the 4 generals with the important assignments made little progress, for they were attacking major positions. But the nondescript troops trying to scale the west wall became a real threat. Campbell now yelled, Galb, we must run back and forth like we agreed. And these 2, with the assistance of 3 Tennessee men, threw down 1 ladder after another. At the point of great danger, the north wall, General Cos, who had sworn in writing never to return to Tejas under arms, gained 1 crushing success, although at the time he did not know it. Some of his men, firing a blind fusillade, luckily hit a brave Texican who was defending the northern gun batteries. This man took a shot through the head, pitching backward into the dusty yard. The dead man was Colonel William Travis, whose iron will had kept his men in the Alamo. The grinding assault came at the palisade, where Davy Crockett had lined up his Tennessee sharpshooters, with Mordecai Marr and 12 Kentucky men in support. These tough veterans laid down a continuous rifle fire, but the pressure against them was unyielding, because General Riparda had an unlimited supply of barefoot Yucatan Indians whom he proposed to use as human battering rams. When Benito Garza first heard his assignment, you'll lead the third wave, he found it difficult to accept, for he knew how perilous such an attack would be. But when he watched the first wave move out and get mowed down every man by that unrelenting fire from the palisade, he lost all fear and began to shout to the second wave, Take that line of sticks! Damn it, rush them! And when this wave lost more than 80% of its numbers, he could hardly wait to lead his charge. Riparda, cold and stiff as ever, moved always closer to the palisade, ignoring both the whistling bullets and the appalling loss of his Indians. Garza, you'll succeed. Drive right at the center. And he watched with impassive approval as Benito leaped forward, bringing his horde behind him. On this bloody Sunday, Texican and Mexican alike showed what courage was. At the west wall, Campbell mustered a brilliant defense, running back and forth, firing his four rifles with devastating effect, and reloading as he ran. "We knocked them back," Galba Fuqua shouted to his mentor, who called back, "Use your pole. Keep pushing them ladders down." And so the first hour ended, with no Mexican having gained the top of the wall. It was now nearing 6, and Santa Ana's bold boast to be inside the walls by sunrise had failed. Now he threw in fresh troops, who came at the weakened walls with a roar and the popping of guns. The lack of range was no longer important, for the guns were discharged at a distance of 30 feet, and often with telling effect, as brave Texicans began toppling backward like their commander. By 6, the remaining Texicans numbered only slightly over 100. And still, those irrepressible Indians and mestizos came at them, little men of giant courage, for they climbed bare-handed up the walls, or placed their ladders and held them in the face of withering gunfire, while those behind them scrambled to the top to be greeted by swinging gun butts in the face. But on they came, hundreds of them, thousands it seemed, and for every 6 of them slain, a Texican fell off the wall, a bullet through his head, or a knife through his breast. At the southern end, Colonel Morales led his troops in a vain assault on the main gate. But as the Texicans cheered his repulse, he slid easily along to the western end of that wall and surprised its defenders with a bayonet attack. The Mexicans swarmed on and gained a major advantage, for they were now inside the walls. At almost the same moment, Generals Cos and Duque applied maximum pressure at a weak point in the north wall, and there another breach was made. Before the irresistible whiteclads could storm into the central area, Benito Garza and his Yucatan troops engulfed the palisade, overrunning old Mordecai Mar, who continued trying to reload even when on his knees. 3 bayonets ended his adventurous life. At this moment, Zave Campbell, still atop the roof and still pushing away ladders, uttered a terrible cry of pain. At this moment, Zave Campbell, still atop the roof and still pushing away ladders, uttered a terrible cry of pain. Not for himself, but for his much-loved companion of these past days, Galba Fuqua, who had taken a pair of bullets right through his upper and lower jaws, blowing away a part of his brave young face. Zave saw the lad put his hand to his head, then blanch and almost faint when he found what had happened. "Galb, go down to where the women are. Get help." With great force, he lifted the boy from the post he had defended so valiantly and dropped him to the ground, watching him as he trailed blood across the yard. Now he fought with deadly vigor, slashing, killing. Once he waited like a cat till 2 men climbed the ladder at the spot left vacant by Fuqua, then dashed forth like a tiger, swinging one of his guns like a madman and crushing skulls. He was about to return to his own spot, where Mexicans were close to controlling the wall, when he saw Galba climb back onto the wall to resume his duty. When Zave saw the bloody mass, he began to vomit, and for some moments he was immobilized, whereupon the boy kicked him and moved the remnant of his face as if he were saying, "Courage, old man, don't play the coward now." With an anguished roar, speaking for them both, Zave shouted at the climbing myrmidons, "Come ahead, you bastards!" And he saw with horror how they did come, 8 of them, and how they leaped upon Galba Fuqua and stabbed him a score of times, tossing his body like a sheaf of threshed wheat to the ground below. Now it was Zave Campbell, with his 4 rifles no longer of use except as clubs, who rushed at the 20 who stormed the rooftop. Swinging and cursing and lashing out with his 2 knives, he held them at bay for some moments, sending 3 more to their deaths. But not even he could restrain the overwhelming force of this assault, for while he was defending himself against assailants in front, 3 others crept up on him from behind, and 1 stabbed him with such terrible force that the point of the bayonet reached out 4 inches from his breast. He was so astonished to see it that he gasped, reached down to pull it away with his bare hand, and took 9 other stabs simultaneously. Giving a wild bellow of rage, he grabbed for his tormentors and died, draped across the wall he had defended with such valor. Not 3 minutes later, James Bonham, hero of heroes, tried to hold off 6 attackers at the Mission Chapel, but was overpowered. He died, taking several of the enemy with him. Now all was confusion, and by 6:30 in the morning, triumphant bugle calls echoed across the big field as Santa Anna's victorious troops searched every corner of the Alamo's defenses for any remaining Texicans. Whenever they found one, they obeyed their general's stern command: no prisoners. Men who had fought bravely until all hope was gone endeavored to surrender, but were either gunned down or pierced by bayonets. There were no prisoners, not among the men, although Amalia Marr and the other women who were inside the walls were spared. Jim Bowie in his cot was bayoneted. Long after the terrible victory, when men were trying to sort out details of what had happened to the 182 Texicans, a Mexican officer claimed that the last of the famous defenders to survive was Davy Crockett. He hid under a pile of women's clothes and begged and pleaded and wept when we trapped him. Said he would do anything if we spared him, but we shot him in contempt. Unlikely, that. Who were these heroes who died defending the Alamo? From what terrain did they come, and upon what traditions had they been reared to make them willing to give their lives for the freedom of a territory to which they had so recently come? 10 were born in England, 12 in Northern Ireland, 3 in Scotland, 2 in Germany, and 1 each in Wales and Denmark. Those born in the United States were 31 from Tennessee, 14 from Kentucky, 5 from Alabama, 4 from Mississippi, 5 from Georgia, 13 from the Carolinas, 11 from Virginia, 12 from Pennsylvania, and a scattering of others from Vermont, Louisiana, Missouri, New York, New Jersey, Ohio, Massachusetts, and Illinois. Of the heroic congregation, only 6 had been born in Texas itself. Their names: Abamillo, Badillo, Espalier, Esparza, Fuentes, Nava. Mexicans all. Juan Seguin, who was in the Alamo when the siege began, we shall see shortly. By 7 that Sunday morning, the battle was over, as complete a victory as any general could have hoped for. The Tejas Rebellion was crushed almost before it was fairly launched, and Santa Anna, joyous in his triumph, gave one last order: burn them all. And the pyre was lit, and all but one were burned. By special dispensation of General Cos, the body of Gregorio Esparza was released to his brother for burial. Into an unmarked grave, unhonored and spat upon, were thrown the ashes of the Alamo heroes. But even before the acrid fumes from the fire died away, men in various parts of the world were beginning to utter the name with reverence and anger and hope and determination. The Alamo, screamed newspapers throughout America. The Alamo, whispered men to their wives as they prepared to leave for greater battles in the future. And in the weeks ahead, when men from all parts of Texas and the United States began to muster to avenge this savagery, they voiced a threat, a blood oath that would bind them together: remember the Alamo. From the heroism of these ordinary men, from their unmarked grave, rose an echo of immortality. By their deaths, the living were morally obligated to finish what they had begun. From their skeletons, burned to ashes, the backbone of a new nation would be formed. Where was General Sam Houston, the hero of Texas history, when such events were taking place? As one of many would-be commanders-in-chief, he had tried desperately to bring order to the defense of Texas, and he had failed. Abandon the Alamo and blow it up, he had counseled Travis, who had disobeyed him for his own heroic reasons. Abandon Goliad and blow it up, he had ordered Colonel Fannin weeks ago, and again he had been ignored. Like Achilles before Troy, he sulked, this time among his beloved Cherokee, whom he visited to help them regularize their relations with the United States, and especially with the Texas that was now arising. If the present leaders of the emerging nation were proving themselves to be a gang of inept fools, so be it. He would do his job with the Indians and return when the real fighting men were willing to listen, to retreat in orderly fashion, to suck Santa Ana ever deeper into perilous terrain, and to save all energy for one titanic effort against the Mexicans, whose supply lines would grow longer and longer and always more difficult to defend against those backwoods tactics which had proved so disastrous to British hopes in years gone by. Sam Houston became an American version of the Roman Fabius Maximus, derisively nicknamed Cunctator, the Dawdler, who in 217 B.C. avoided defeat by the Carthaginian Hannibal through a series of skillful retreats that wore down the enemy. Houston devised a masterly plan which would enable him to do the same with Santa Anna, who had a vastly superior army, good cannon, able generals, and everything in his favor except time and distance. These two lesser advantages, he thought, could defeat the Mexican dictator. Houston was in Gonzales when he learned that the Alamo had fallen. The morning and evening guns, which had reassured distant listeners that the mission remained in Texican hands, had fallen silent. So he was not surprised when a woman Santa Anna had released, for the sole purpose of spreading her tale of terror, reached Gonzales with the awful news that all the Texicans, including the 32 from Gonzales, were dead. Then began the great retreat, the runaway scrape, in which civilians fled before the onrushing Mexicans. Towns were abandoned and set to the torch by their inhabitants. Cattle were herded north and east, then left to fend for themselves at river crossings. Hamlets were left bare. Nothing seemed able to halt the victorious dictator. To Sam Houston, retreating like the others, one thing became essential. Colonel Fannin must get his men out of that trap in Goliad. He must bring his forces north to unite with ours. The safety of all Texas depends upon his actions now.